listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, Bob. It's a pleasure to be back.
Good to see you again. You've been on the podcast once before. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Rob.
I'm Robert Wiblin. Yeah, I'm head research at 80,000 Hours. And I guess for the purposes of this conversation, my background is, I guess I've been involved in the effective altruism community slash movement slash set of ideas since around 2012. So I've seen how things have evolved over the years. Happy to talk about it.
And we're going to talk about that. So 80,000 Hours, which, by the way, I recommend, it's one of my favorite podcasts, and which you co-host, is associated with the Center for Effective Altruism. Is that still true?
Yes, it's complicated. It could be a little bit tedious for the audience. Yes.
Well, we don't. The Center for Effective Altruism, my main point is, it is maybe the main institutional incarnation of effective altruism, which is something we're going to talk about. I gather it was founded by two of the main, if there are three philosophers associated with effective altruism, two of them founded it, right? Toby Ord and Will McCaskill, Peter That's Singer it. Being the third philosopher I had in mind.
Yeah.
And there's some kind of connection between it and the podcast, or was, or something?
Right. So, yes. So at the moment, you've got the Center for Effective Altruism, which helps to organize effective altruism community effectively. You know, it runs conferences and things like that. It's part of this legal entity called Effective Ventures, which is kind of the fiscal sponsor of the Center for Effective Altruism. And that's also the fiscal sponsor of 80,000 Hours. And the fiscal sponsor of the nonprofit sector is the legal entity that receives the donations, basically.
Okay. So your podcast is like kind of like a sibling of Center for Effective Altruism or something.
Yeah, we definitely cover a lot of topics that are of great interest to people in effective altruism. I guess not exclusively, but the tagline of the show is the world's most pressing problems and how you can use your career to solve them. And that basically is what we try to keep coming back to.
That's where 80,000 hours comes from. You did the math, and there, and my career consists of exactly 80,000 hours, right?
I think you and I may not have quite that many hours left, but to the young people in the audience, I think if you're graduating,
I certainly believe me. I recognize that most of my 80,000 hours are behind me. I've done that much math, Rob. Don't worry. Okay. So, listen, the reason I wanted to have you on the podcast again is because effective altruism, which again you're not a formal representative of, but have been very involved with, has been in the news over the past couple of years in some ways that probably didn't make your life easier and you weren't entirely happy about. The big one being Sam Bankman-Fried, of course, who was a professed effective altruism, a supporter of EA Ventures. I assume he had donated money to the Center for Effective Altruism or one of these entities we just mentioned. He was a supporter.
Yeah.
You know, he effective altruism, you know, joined the news cycle along with him and came in for some criticism, various principles ranging from philosophical principles associated with it, like utilitarianism, to principles that effective altruism has advanced, like earn to give. In other words, the idea that, look, if you want to do good, you don't have to do it Mother Teresa style by actually going over to Africa and handing out mosquito nets. You can make a ton of money and donate a lot of it. So that whole principle fell under criticism. Then there was a second wave of controversy that was a little more ambiguous, I would think, from your point of view. Whether it was bad publicity or good depended on where you stood. And I'm talking about the OpenAI board's showdown with Sam Altman. That was depicted by some as a kind of a fight between some effective altruist types on the board and Sam Altman. I don't know how much truth there was in that, but in any event, some of the pro Altman people depicted EA as this kind of dark force, you know, behind the scenes trying to dethrone their hero, I guess. And interesting questions were raised there, specifically with respect to artificial intelligence and EA and what it's come to mean. So I wanted to, and also I noticed that in the course of the publicity surrounding that, effective altruism was described in what I thought was some, at best, oversimplified ways. Like, here's a quote from the New York Times, referring to Eliezer Yudkowsky, who is, of course, AI doomer-in-chief. It says, Mr. Yudkowsky was a leader in a community of people who called themselves rationalists or, in later years, effective altruists. Well, I mean, there is overlap between the community known as rationalists and the community known as effective altruists. I wouldn't say that they're one and the same, and there was just a relabeling, right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty off base. I'm a little bit surprising that a journalist would write that and not run it past the people who could explain the reality of the situation. But yeah, we could go into that if you like.
Yeah, so I want to get into the whole thing, and I'm glad that you've got, I think you've got a fair amount of time to spare. Let's start, well, kind of at the beginning. I don't want to over-dramatize it, but do you remember where you were when you heard about the Sam Bankman-Fried fiasco?
I do, yes. I think I was in the office and I initially heard that FTX was having some financial problems. I suppose initially for the first few days, it sounded like, you know, maybe they just made some bad business dealings and they were no longer liquid or no longer solvent or the company was going to be bought out. I think, to be honest, like, so I knew about Sam Bankman-Fried's philanthropic activities. I must admit, I don't have an enormous interest in crypto I didn't have much of an interest in FTX as a business. So I hadn't really been tracking it very much. And so that certainly came out of left field for me. I guess it gradually came out over the coming week that it looked like there might have been particular, like very serious crimes committed in the process of FTX going under. And basically that has turned out to be correct. It seemed like there was a substantial level of fraud, misappropriation of funds, theft, more or less, that occurred in FTX. And I guess its sister organization, the hedge fund, Alameda Research, through 2022. So we could go into, I'm not sure how familiar audience will be or the audience will be with the details of what happened at FTX. But more or less, it seemed like Sam and at least a handful of colleagues were involved in effectively stealing funds from people who had money deposited at FTX, which they did, I think, in order to try to prop up this hedge fund that Sam had a stake in, which had lost a whole lot of money. And they were hoping that they would be able to take the money from FTX depositors, prop up the hedge fund, and then make everyone whole afterwards. That would be my guess as to the plan. But this was criminal, illegal, horribly immoral. And the whole thing went belly up, and both of them ended up going bankrupt.
Yeah, I think he had both given the people who deposited money in FTX the impression that the money was there, just kind of literally there, not being handed out to Alameda. And also, I think in the case, it became apparent that he had misled, I forget whether it was investors in Alameda or lenders to Alameda, about the status of Alameda's balance sheet. And
I mean, I'd assumed, I think like the great majority of people had assumed that they were simply holding the crypto assets, you know, not lending them out, not using them for anything. They were simply holding onto them like gold in a vault. As it turned out, that was not the case. And they'd been doing all kinds of stuff with the money that was deposited there. And then when they lost that money, then the depositors were in deep trouble.
Yeah. Have you read Michael Lewis's book about?
I've read a summary of it. I haven't read the whole thing yet. I'll get to it at some point.
It's taken some heat, but I think it's very valuable in giving us a sense for what probably the best guess we can get as to what Sam Bankman-Fried is really like. He's an unusual character. You had him on the podcast at one point.
I did.
Do you have a take? Do you have a kind of a theory of Sam?
So, since this came out, I've kind of been torn between two different explanations for what happened. I think a very natural one will be to think, well, he was this ultra-utilitarian, like expected value-maximizing person who lacked moral restraint. And basically, when the business was facing problems, he didn't feel any compunction about stealing the money effectively because he thought that it had positive expected financial value. And that would mean he'd be able to make more money both to give away to the causes that he cared about and I guess to do anything else with the money that he wanted. And I think having read Michael Lewis or having read the summary of Michael Lewis's book, it certainly seems like that was a factor. There was some of that going on that definitely describes some of the dynamic. The other thing that I thought was very plausible that would go on, and I think probably is another factor to what happened, is just it's not uncommon for people in the financial industry, in hedge funds or in investment banks, that they lose a whole lot of money and then they basically do a double or nothing thing where they manage to grab some resources elsewhere, make big bets mm-hmm. on the stock market, hope that they'll be able to make the thing whole, save their reputation, save the business, not get fired. And I think people in these industries often tend to be quite overconfident about their own estimations of what the expected returns are, what the risks are that they're taking. Mm-hmm. And it's just a very natural thing when you've gone from being a huge hero and being lauded in the financial press to having the prospect of your business completely going bankrupt, that especially if you're a risk-taking person by personality, which I think Sam Bankman-Fried certainly was, that there's a very strong temptation to do this double or nothing game, basically, where you have a 50% chance maybe of saving your situation and 50% chance of becoming a pariah. Seems like he maybe took that bet, as a number of people have over the years when their businesses have, or they're part of a business has run into trouble.
Yeah. I've always thought it was possible even that Madoff got into his trouble that way, initially just trying to cover some trouble he had suddenly run into. And, I don't know. There are slippery slopes that people can step onto for sure. I did get the sense from the Michael Lewis book that, he was sincere about the effective altruism. Now, what does that mean? I mean, all human beings pretty much tell themselves that they're doing good, right? So the whole question of what it means to say you're motivated by altruism is kind of an amorphous one. But I certainly think he probably believed that himself. And then I think there was some element of what you alluded to, which is expected value. I mean, we should say to people, aren't familiar with the idea. It's just that, if you have a 50% chance of winning $5 and you're betting even money to 50, then the expected return is, well, I guess the expected return is zero in that case, right? Because am I doing this right? You tell me, you're in this business. but if you have a 60% chance of making a dollar, then the expected return is 60 cents. And most human beings add a second factor, which is risk, degree of risk aversion. Yeah. And some speculation is that Sam Bankman-Fried just didn't do that part. And in fact, he actually said as much famously a couple of times, one on Tyler Cowen's podcast, where he said, Tyler said, well, suppose you could flip a coin and the chances are 50% that the world just becomes way, way better, much more than twice as good as it is now. So there's the expected return is way positive. But then if it comes out the wrong way, everything blows up and there's no more world. And I think basically Sam Bankman-Fried said, oh, sure, I'd take that. And then Tyler said, and then would you do it again? And he said, oh, sure, I'd do it again. Would you do it again? Well, sure, I'd do it. Well, of course, at some point, this is literally crazy. I mean, because you're almost guaranteed to ultimately blow everything up. But he said, at least, that that's what he would do. And I don't know. Do you have any sense for whether he kind of, he was in some ways not kind of an ordinary human being, it seems.
No, I think psychologically he was very unusual. I think it's clear he didn't have the instinctive fear of risk or of downside that a normal person has, certainly than that I have. And I think many people who end up, I think, in situations like his, where they're running an enormous business, often they are extremely risk-taking by nature. And that's how they've managed, by winning up a series of bets like that, they've managed to get into a position of great influence. And I think it's not then uncommon that they continue taking enormous risks because they're very overconfident or just temperamentally act that way. And then it eventually blows up. So I think that's one factor. I agree. Most people at a degree of risk aversion. And I think that on the Tyler Cohen podcast, the situation was actually not as generous to Sam as you're portraying. I think it was more like a 51% chance that you duplicate the universe. So there's twice as much of everything, or a 49% chance that everything is destroyed. And Sam said, "Yeah, I would take that bet," which, I mean, I would not take that bet. I don't think many listeners would. Because obviously you're running a 49% chance of destroying all value, including yourself and everything you care about. So I would not, I would not recommend that anyone accept that level of, I mean, philosophically, in decision theory, that would be called, I guess, risk neutrality about internal value.
Yeah.
I think there's just a general philosophical puzzle here around how do we use expected value. It's often is referred to as kind of the St. Petersburg paradox. So you can imagine that you could sharpen this question where you say, well, what if there's a 99.9% chance that you'll increase the value in the universe by 100-fold, but with a 0.1% chance of destroying it? So you might say, well, at that level of stakes, maybe I would accept the risk. But then if you keep repeating it, as you say, then you end up with the view that, well, sure, you have an infinitesimal probability of an enormously valuable universe, but an overwhelming chance that you've got nothing whatsoever. And this basic style of paradox shows up in decision theory and efforts to figure out how do you use expected value and how do you trade off rewards versus probability, rewards versus risk. And I'd say philosophers just don't have a solution to a lot of those, to that underlying problem. Yeah. It's an as yet unsolved set of issues in a particular branch of philosophy, but I think that does not excuse one to make it going in wholeheartedly, enthusiastically embracing such a insane answer to the question.
Right. Now I actually haven't heard the Tyler Cowen podcast. Was I right that he went on to say, "And would you do it again?" Or did I make that part up? Go ahead.
I think that he said yes, that he would take it repeatedly. I could explain where I think Sam went wrong, and it's on several different levels.
I think many of us already have an intuition about that, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I would say, so one thing is, I think if you even find yourself asking the question, should I steal all of this money in order to try to prop up my business, in order to make more money to give away, then kind of you're already have made a big mistake in how you're trying to make yourself, well, what sort of person you're trying to become. In practice, I think whether you're, you know, whatever moral philosophy you're into, in practice, people should be trying to become virtuous people who ask the right questions and have the right instincts about what things are reasonable to do and what things are not. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone should be trying to cultivate the virtue of not being inclined to ask the question, should I steal all of this money or should I commit this horrible crime in pursuit of my personal project? So there's kind of the virtue angle. Then just even if setting that aside, if you are going to ask the question, I think you should give a lot of weight to stealing is wrong, taking other people's resources is wrong, violating their rights is wrong. So even though I think there might be good consequences and expectation from this extremely risky action, I'm still not going to do it because there are just constraints. There are rules that one has to follow, rules of good conduct, and this violates them insanely flagrantly. So there's that. And then if you set that aside and say, well, I'm not going to care about following rules, I'm not going to care about coordinating with other people or acting fairly or justly, then even if you are only thinking about maximizing expected value, then I think what he did is still crazy because it's just not, you know, from a personal point of view, I think it was crazy because, I mean, look at even if it was only selfish, then it was nuts because
doesn't
he still
seem
could have
to
gone
have
on,
worked out well for him.
Doesn't
no.
seem to have worked out well. It's an extremely bad outcome for him personally. And then in terms of the effects on the world, it's not the case that the problem, like the things that he cared about, they so desperately needed his funding that it was worth bringing them into enormous disrepute, trashing the reputation of all of the causes that he had seemingly been trying to help to fix, in order to give us some, to give them some chance of having additional funding. Mm-hmm. In fact, things had been going very well within those problem areas. Lots of people had been getting on board, trying to help, you know, with factory farming, with risk from pandemics, on down the line before Sam Bankman-Fried had any money to give away at all. So there was every reason to be extremely risk averse about the amount of funding available, and also about the reputation. And I think any sensible consequentialist or utilitarian analysis would have said, no, just simply allow the hedge fund to go under. It's totally fine, even setting aside all of the reasons why you shouldn't go and engage in that action. So a lot of mistakes, both kind of practical and ethical.
Yeah, the you mentioned virtue just now. I'm not sure that's permissible in the philosophical circles that are said to dominate EA. Let's talk just a little about. Sure. Let me put that off for one second. I want to get into the question of utilitarianism, which is, I would say, the main guiding philosophical foundation of EA. Although there are different, you know, variants of utilitarianism. I want to get into that, but first, before I forget, has any of this given you second thoughts about the idea of earn to give, which I think you had been a champion of before? It makes sense on paper, that there are definitely a lot of people who, in principle, could do a lot more good by donating a fair amount of their earnings to charities than by becoming one worker in one of those charities. Makes sense. But I guess, you know, some people would say that the SBF story illustrates some kind of pitfalls. I don't know. Have you had any second thoughts?
Yes. I think it's definitely a strike against it. As we say, I guess it's an update against the idea. It's hard for it not to be.
You've updated your priors a little, as they say. Exactly, in rationalist circles.
As the jargon goes.
Yeah.
Yes, it definitely is. I mean, it's a little bit hard to know how should you update against it? Because on the one hand, it's ended up being a large fraction of all of the effects that the idea of voting to give has had is, in practice, has been to, I guess, contribute to Sam Bankman-Fried going and doing the stuff that he's done. So in terms of its like overall average effect, it's a huge influence. If you wanted to do it by number of people, then you'd say, well, there's many thousands, possibly tens of thousands of people, broadly speaking, who have chosen higher paying jobs in order to be able to donate more because they think that that's the best way that they can contribute personally to solving serious problems in the world. And of them, how many of them have gone and committed crimes or done things that are grossly immoral like this? I guess we've got an example of definitely one, possibly three or more in the FTX case. Presumably there are some other people who've gone and done less serious things, but things that I would probably question, say they're not super, super moral out of that remaining tens of thousands of people who are broadly adopting this strategy. But it's probably a pretty small fraction of the total. So has the idea gotten someone unlucky in prompting this particular event? And in fact, it's not going to happen very, very much going forward. Hard to say. I mean, people did raise this concern from the beginning that going into some industries, I guess like finance perhaps, could cause you to be around people who might negatively influence you, or it could cause you to lose your moral constraints just because maybe being in business, being exposed to the incentives to make money could reduce your virtue, could make you a more unhinged person. I think most people, that's not going to be a huge effect. And I think we have lots of examples of people going into finance, making money and giving it away and just seemingly being the same sensible kind of people I'd like to hang out with and be friends with all mm-hmm. the same. But it does, I guess in particular, it worries me that the people who might end up most influential with the most money to give away will often be people who have taken enormous risks in business, because that is one way that you can make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to really play double or nothing again and again and again. So there probably is a systematic bias towards the people who end up being perhaps the billionaires who have adopted an earning to give strategy might be people who you don't want to emulate and whose behavior could often end up being harmful or reckless. So that certainly worries me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there may be a couple of other things about SBF that are relevant that come through in the Lewis book. One is that he seems to have been a person who really didn't care much about other people, even in the sense of being curious about them, let alone kind of feeling their pain or anything like that, and didn't care that much about their opinion of him. I think I'm getting that kind of right. But one thing Michael says in the book is Sam Bankman-Fried never asked him a question about himself, never said, you know, in all the time they spent together, never said, what's it like to be a writer or what's your next book or anything. It's just, that he kind of always, almost gave people the impression that he didn't care that much about their lives. The other thing is that, and maybe it's kind of related, is that he grew up more than even most of his contemporaries and kind of a demographic cousin, you know, people kind of in his demographic, in a world of video games. He didn't do well socially. He didn't have a real physical social life, but got totally immersed in video games. And, you know, one can only conjecture whether that leads you to a more detached, you know, approach to all of the little calculations you're making in real life and the risks they entail and so on. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it certainly does seem that he was much more interested in, I guess, business ideas, systematic thinking more so than people. I'm reluctant to say that's the thing that drove him to engage in these behaviors, because many people fall into that camp. I mean, I guess, like, relative to average, I suppose I'm probably more interested in ideas and philosophy than I am in people relative to a randomly chosen person. But I don't think I'm in any way inclined to engage in that SBF, kind of...
I've listened to your podcast. I don't think you're in SBF territory in terms of your indifference to the lives of others.
Yeah. So I wouldn't want to... I mean, maybe it's a partial explanation, but I think I wouldn't want to excuse or give that as the primary explanation. It did seem like it's more than like having a massive interest in other people. It seemed like his personal relationships were quite odd in that he didn't have, you know, deep affection for the people in his own personal life. And I think that's a bit more unusual. And so that perhaps stands out more as a distinctive thing that perhaps could contribute to... unusual behavior as well. So I never thought of the video game angle. I would guess that it's more that if you're less interested in people, perhaps you're more interested in video games rather than the video games driving it. But
it can work both ways. Yeah.
I mean, there is a thing, perhaps having the sense that I'm just playing a game and I'm just trying to make the best decision within the structure of a game. If that's your mentality in normal life, perhaps that does cause you to be looking for edge cases, looking for ways to exploit the rules. In a way that someone who wasn't familiar with that way of thinking about the world, it wouldn't jump out at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to put in one more good word from Michael Lewis's book. I know, Michael, I'm maybe a little biased, but he's taking heat for not sufficiently villainizing Sam Bankman-Fried, and maybe for just not getting into the criminal allegations very much at all. Mm-hmm. Although that may have had to do with the timing of writing the book relative to the court case. I don't know. But his attitude of relative detachment, a kind of journalistic detachment, I think is what allows him to depict certain aspects of Bankman-Fried. He just wouldn't see if you were quicker to judge him, so to speak. Yeah. And I think there's always value in just trying to step back and assess before judging. So I'd recommend that people read that book. Now, on this philosophical, it's called Going Infinite. On this philosophical question, and of course he raises this too. I mean, we've already gotten into it in a way, and because when we were talking about his expected return calculations and continuing to flip that coin with all of humankind at stake, we're talking about a kind of utilitarian calculation, the idea being that human welfare or happiness, however you want to put it, is a good thing, and that that your goal should be to maximize human welfare. Or, you know, there are various ways of putting it. Peter Singer, whom we mentioned earlier, is of course a utilitarian. And one thing I want to eventually get into is how EA kind of evolved after Peter was associated with its origins. Peter is less of a, quote, long-termist, which is, of course, the kind of the variant of EA, I guess, that gets EA very interested in AI and a lot of other issues. I want to get into that. But for now, on the philosophical issue, utilitarianism is often contrasted with, among other kinds of ethics, virtue ethics, right? Mm. So like, you know, I just have these basic, you know, honesty, loyalty, whatever they are. You make whatever virtues they are. If it's more like a series of rules that you never violate, and less like a kind of consideration of the consequences of your actions for other people, then it's more of a virtue ethics. But you were using the word virtue in a pretty approving way there. Are you yourself a sounds like maybe you're not a strict utilitarian, or?
Well, I think that there's two ways that you could get to talking about and caring about virtues. One would be to embrace kind of the theory of ethics that is virtue ethics and say, well, no, fundamentally what is of importance in the universe is cultivating virtue, trying to mm-hmm. become a virtuous person. I don't go in for that so much. I'm not sure what the meta-ethical grounding of virtue ethics would be. Perhaps I haven't investigated that fully, so I wouldn't say there's nothing that you could forward there. But the way I think about it more is, even if you were committed to utilitarianism only, which I'm certainly not, there's a branch of utilitarianism called global utilitarianism, which would say not only should you evaluate outcomes on their consequences and how good they are, but you can evaluate everything based on the kind of consequences that it tends to produce. And then you can end up saying, well, what sort of character tends to produce good outcomes? And basically you would end up calling those virtues and mm-hmm. saying, well, in practice, would people have more positive effects on the world if they tried to cultivate virtues and thought about their behavior and thought about themselves in terms of, am I acting virtuously? Am I mm-hmm. becoming a more virtuous person with my actions? And I think the answer in practice is yes. That is a very extremely important part of how you should try to become a person who positively affects the world. So you could value virtues for their own sake, or you could value virtues because you think they'll have good consequences, and this is a good framework for thinking about the effects you'll have. I think the former is maybe on a bit more shaky ground. The latter, I think, is on very strong ground. Mm-hmm. But certainly, as a pragmatic issue, I think about virtue personally, and I think other people should do so as well. If I heard someone who was saying, I don't care about how I don't think or care about whether I am acting virtuously, then I'd say, well, I think you're on very shaky ground there. And that could lead you to make big mistakes.
Yeah. Now, is that what is sometimes called rule-based ethics as opposed to act? I mean, rule-based utilitarianism as opposed to act-based utilitarianism? In other words, you don't just say, if I can kill this baby to save five people, I should do it. You also say, well, wait a second. What if we had a world in which it was considered acceptable to kill a baby to save five? Wouldn't everyone live in terror and clutch their babies constantly, right? So that's bad. That's a bad net consequence, right? That's what rule-based utilitarianism would say.
Yes. Yes, I'm not a moral philosopher by training, but they're certainly related where, I mean, one take you could have as a consequentialist is asking, well, what norms, what rules as a society could we follow that would tend to lead to good outcomes? And that leads you exactly down that line. We're saying, well, in this specific hypothetical case, possibly violating this social convention would be good. However, the convention itself is good and is something that should be encouraged and indeed maybe pushed on people, because if we stopped following that convention, then that would lead to bad outcomes in general. I mean, it makes a ton of sense, right?
Yeah. It's funny. I did an event with Peter Singer just a few weeks ago at a bookstore. It was about his new book, The Buddhist and the Ethicist, which I also recommend. And I asked him if he was a rule-based or act-based utilitarian. I thought he was going to say rule-based. I hadn't asked him that before. He said act-based. Now, I do think there are nuances in his version of act-based utilitarianism that would prevent him from embracing a whole lot of things a whole lot of kind of atrocious thought experiment type actions that people might associate with crude utilitarianism. But I was surprised, and I didn't, it wasn't the place to interrogate him further about that. But I'm more or less a utilitarian, but I've always stressed that I'm kind of a rule-based utilitarian, which, as you say, can lead to a kind of a virtue-based ethics.
I think you really have to distinguish between high-level moral philosophy theory here and meta ethics and so on, in which it's hard to make the rule utilitarianism work because it you end up with a deflationary story. We say, well, if you specify the rules sufficiently specifically, then it just becomes the same as act utilitarianism. Because you say, well, if we specify every exact part of the hypothetical situation, then we're just down to evaluating the act itself in that particular case. And why should we talk about it at just a level of generality, where we say, you know, considering all of the situations in which someone is making a given trade-off, what should they do on average? Why not be more precise about it? However, you know, and I think that maybe makes sense as a matter of in the philosophy seminar room. In practice, as actual human beings going about in the world, if I think about how should I think about my behavior, what will cause me to be a positive influence in the world, I think that doesn't add very much insight. And instead, thinking I'm just going to be the kind of person who generally follows the law, who generally follows social conventions on things that almost everyone agrees, even if you were kind of a super brain that could think about every specific situation and always choose the best action, then maybe you should just think about acts without making any generalizations about what styles of behavior are beneficial. In practice, given just how constrained I am and how biased I might be towards preferring particular results and skewing things towards what's convenient at the time, instead, in practice, I should follow rules and I should think about virtue a lot. Not exclusively. You should also sometimes think about the specific consequences of your actions in a given case when the stakes seem very large, and maybe you're not like, should you ever maybe skirt a social convention in order to have massively positive consequences? Yes. But I think that you should be doing that analysis and thinking, well, this is good on a virtue thing, bad on a rule thing, good in terms of it looks good as an individual act, rather than only just thinking about it from the individual act point of view.
Yeah, I think so. You mentioned both the practical difficulty of calculating the consequences, but also you mentioned bias, which I think is really important. Because given what we now know about the subtlety of cognitive biases, and honestly, for all the talk about cognitive biases, I don't think there is a full appreciation of either the range of cognitive biases that lead to endless violent conflict or the subtlety of them. And I think when you do take those things into consideration, you realize that it would be a pretty unusual human being who could, you know, talk about, for example, a conflict that their country is involved in with anything like objectivity in terms of, you know, actually assessing, well, the bias itself affects the calculation of consequences.
I mean, SBF is a good example of this, where if he had cultivated the kind of personality where he would simply regard it as completely unacceptable to pilfer depositors' money, no matter the circumstances, then he would have had more positive consequences on the world. And I think that's extremely predictable. And it's very predictable for the rest of us too, that in our more mundane cases, if we cultivate the kind of personality that doesn't ask the question, should I steal the money, then you end up being a more beneficial person.
Yeah. So I want to get into long-termism and how EA evolved in that direction. And Peter, I think, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he didn't fully embrace that. He didn't stay fully on board for all of that, I think. Of course, it depends on what you mean by long-termism. What do you mean by long-termism?
Yeah, I think so. I guess there's a variety of descriptions. I suppose the more mild one would be to say that thinking about whether we are producing a good long-term outcome for civilization and where humanity goes, that's one of the important moral challenges of our time. I think that would be a mild description of it, saying this is at least one of the key things that we as people and we as a society ought to be thinking about, is where are we going to be in a couple of hundred years' time? Where are we going to be in thousands of years' time? Because I think people also sometimes talk about hard long-termism, which is, I guess, the idea that the overwhelming majority of the impact that we have or moral influence that we have is over, it comes via effects that we have, you know, long after we're gone, for, you know, more than 100 or 1,000 years in the future. So that'd be a more extreme take. And it could lead you to say, well, not only is this kind of one of the most important problems, but probably it is the most important problem.
And this of course, is part of what got EA people interested in AI, or some of them intensely interested. Yes, I can already see that you're going to qualify what I just said, but let me just flesh this out for people. So
sure.
The idea, one idea that grows out of long-termism is, if there is a truly existential risk that's going to could wipe out all of life on Earth, and you're thinking and you're a long-term thinking utilitarian, well, that is something you should be willing to pay a pretty great cost to avoid, even if the chances of it are small, if you do the math. In fact, one problem is the math is kind of undoable because you're dealing with infinities here, right? Like, it's like...
you end up with extremely low probability. Well, yeah. This brings back kind of St. Petersburg paradox issue, that it seems like expected value runs into lots of troubles when you're talking about extremely low probabilities or extremely large benefits, or if they're converging on infinity or are infinite. Then the whole mechanism seems to kind of break and become extremely counterintuitive.
Right. And the other thing is, maybe relatedly, there's a question of like, how many actually existential risks are there? If by existential you mean wipes out all of human life, there aren't many. I think most people would say even nuclear war probably wouldn't quite kill everyone.
Not directly.
I'm against it, of course, but it doesn't in terms of how it would plug into the math. You know, it's not true extinction. I guess in a certain sense, the AI doom, the hardcore AI doomers, the Yudkowskyite doomers, are almost the only ones who are throwing out a true extinction scenario, which I personally consider quite unlikely. But in their scenario, right, there's a superintelligence that actually does put an end to human life. And aside from that, it's hard to imagine scenarios, because even horrible pandemics are unlikely to kill everyone, and so on. Biological weapons attacks basically are horrible pandemics if they're on a large scale. Does that make sense to you so far? Now, you were going to jump in and qualify something I said. Do that part.
So I was going to say, this might surprise people, but I feel like long-termism just isn't that important in many ways. It's interesting philosophically. It's interesting as a matter of discourse. But in practice, I don't think whether you place, you know, a bit of some weight on the long-term future or a lot of weight on the long-term future makes much difference to what things seem best to work on now. So many people who are thinking about the long-term future of humanity, they end up working on preventing serious pandemics. They end up wanting to make a transition to superhuman AI go better. They want to prevent nuclear war. But all of these things, I think, are completely consistent with not placing that much weight on the long-term future at all. Because I think we're likely to see a transition to a world in which superhuman AI is doing much or all of the work, or is having enormous structural influences on society within my lifetime, potentially within the next 10 years. So I think even if you only concerned yourself for the next 100 years, then thinking about how do we prevent conflict? How do we prevent terrible pandemics? How do we make a transition to superhuman AI go well? Just stand out as excellent opportunities regardless. So in some ways, I think it's a bit of a shame that we've ended up talking so much about the philosophical issues around long-termism, because it just doesn't seem decision relevant a lot of the time.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I've thought about that. There is this critique of long-termism that it devalues present suffering, because in the scheme of things, when you're talking about, you know, billions and billions of years of human life, all of us pale by comparison. And in principle, it would be worth all of us paying a horrible price and enduring horrible suffering if it made the difference between all of those future people existing and them not existing. But again, that's not the real world, because first of all, as I said, nuclear war, pandemics, and so on are not true extinction experiences, so they don't quite fit into the math that way. And then there's a point that you made, which is I have been very concerned about so-called existential risk, which I don't really consider quite existential, because, you know, it affects me and my children and everybody I know. All these things are actually short-term risks. And that includes AI, even aside from the superintelligence aspect. You know, it's about to start disrupting human society in various ways that are going to be challenging, I think. And that's the part of AI risk I focus on. So I agree with you that it's of academic interest, you know, true hardcore long-termism, but of almost no actual practical significance.
Yeah, it could be a practical significance in hypothetical situations that we might face in future. But I don't find it interesting. And it's not personally the thing that motivates me so much today, to be honest. I mean, I don't want to die in a horrible pandemic that's prompted by bioweapons or AI-enabled bioweapons. I'm about to have a kid. I'm very worried about the world that my child is going to grow up in. And so kind of across the board, thinking about myself, my friends, my family, about the world that I want to continue to live in, about, you know, the next generation, as well as generations after that. It kind of all points towards maybe humanity should think more about the effects that it's having, about the risks that it's currently running, and do a bit of a better job at coordinating itself and doing risk management.
Yeah, and this is the sad thing, I think, about what SBF, well, there's more than one sad aspect to the story, I guess, but is like, you know, these problems, pandemic, bioweapons, AI, nuclear war, and lots of other things, I think are just undervalued in our current politics. I mean, it completely blows my mind that I think any reasonable person must concede there's at least some chance that the COVID pandemic was started by a genetically engineered virus that escaped from a lab. Whatever probability, I don't see how you can say there's like zero, right? And you would think that would at a minimum draw our attention to the fact that, wow, we're living in a world where that can happen. So obviously our governance structures are not up to the challenge. It could have very, very easily happened, whether it did or not. And yet there's almost no conversation about that in political discourse.
That's an area where I think people who are associated with effective altruism had got a bit of a win last year, where they were involved in advocating against this USAID program, DeepVZN, or DeepVision. Which was spending $125 million, I believe, to go out and basically hunt for viruses in bat dung, I suppose, out in caves that people never visit, in order to try to anticipate what might be the next pandemic that could jump over from nature. The reasoning being, well, if we could figure that out, we could develop countermeasures ahead of time. But I think a reasonable analysis done by people who didn't have a particular bias in favor of doing this work suggested that it was a negative expected value in that this was far more likely to end up accidentally causing a pandemic than it was to give us the information that we needed to prevent one. And that case ended up, I think, winning the day, and the program was defunded and shut down last year. So there is some discussion of this issue. I think it's more like, well, it is certainly possible that COVID came out of a lab. I think the main thing would be that it was probably a virus that was discovered basically as one of these programs, in these virus hunting programs, and then maybe modified a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. But I think of it more as it's this sort of virus, like, let's go find all of the dangerous viruses and stick them in a lab. We just don't have a sufficiently good record of lab safety and preventing leaks. In fact, we have quite a bad record of it, such that I would just rather not have the next pandemic sitting in a SL2 lab facility somewhere. I'd rather it be in a cave and no one know about it personally.
Mm-hmm. But the possibility that there was alteration of the genetic material, you know, points to a second risk. I mean, first of all, yes, gain of function research can go awry. I wish we'd keep that in mind. But also, there could be some bad actor somewhere that we don't know about who's actually trying to make this happen and unleash a virus. And I think our governance structures are nowhere near up to that challenge. They would have to be, to some extent, international to work. So anyway, there's that. Now, to say that the long-termism thing is kind of overdone, and overdone as a critique of effective altruism, is not to say that effective altruism money has been ideally allocated. And it's not to say that the allocation hasn't been to some extent warped by an overemphasis on some things. And I noticed that on the Center for Effective Altruism website, there's something I've never seen before, which is if you click the about thing, one of the things you can then click on is called mistakes. I've never seen that. And they go through, and I think there's one point where they say they did, there was an undue emphasis, at least at some point in their history, on AI superintelligence, the kind of doomer scenarios. And I wondered, well, first of all, whether you think there's been an overemphasis at times, and also whether the movement fell prey to something that's very easy to fall prey to. You know, I run a very small nonprofit that this podcast is actually part of. And this is not so much an issue for us now because we've kind of moved from a philanthropic donation model to more of a crowdfunding model. But but I noticed back when we were almost wholly reliant on grants that that can very readily shift your focus. Now, you're not going to take on tasks that you actively disapprove of or that aren't in some sense consistent with your mission, but it can lead you to allocate your activities in a way that doesn't proportionately reflect your actual priorities. And I'm wondering if you think that, you know, there's a lot of Silicon Valley money that is in the hands of people who are concerned about, you know, the AI superintelligence risk. I'm wondering if you think that that has at some point had an effect.
Yeah, so I actually took a look at the numbers on this in prepping for this interview. And there are people who've gone and looked at, you know, among the big sources of funding that are associated with effective altruism, where are they? Like, what sort of problem areas are they giving to? And if you split it into, so there's kind of long-termism and existential risk and catastrophic risks and risk from technology, AI, things like that. Maybe let's say that's one cluster. And then there's stuff that's definitely not that, which typically is called global health and well-being work. So this is work to, you know, remove lead from paint in the developing world, to provide bed nets, to prevent people from getting malaria, to do research into new vaccines for malaria, all of that sort of thing. And I think if you go back to the very beginning, looking at the biggest donors, then the ratio is actually 3-1 in favor of the global health and well-being work. Mm. It's gotten quite a lot more money than the work focused on AI or existential risks or things that are associated with long-termism. And that was true last year as well. Actually, it was about a 3-1 ratio between them. So I think many people have the perception that effective altruism as a community, as an intellectual movement, is really dominated by AI and existential risk. And I think I can understand where they get that perception. And I think it's because people have found it more interesting to talk about the last few years. It's in some ways more interesting to talk about artificial intelligence than it is perhaps phase 3 trials of a new malaria vaccine or how are we getting lead out of paint in Malawi. But, you know, just in the background, quietly, there's a lot of projects going on that are focused on present day people and present day problems that I think are having an amazing impact. And I could mention some of them. Now, personally, I think I might individually prefer it to be a bit more towards existential risk and long-termism and artificial intelligence and so on. I think that might be a bit too extreme of a ratio. But it certainly is the case that global health and well-being is large. It's funded a lot. There's many people working on it. It maybe is just underrated. And people don't put as many eyeballs on it as perhaps it warrants.
Yeah. As I said, one context in which this AI risk issue came up was the OpenAI board drama. Mm. I'm kind of and the point made was that two of the board members, it was initially depicted as basically a fight between people on the board very concerned about risk and Sam Altman, who, in the view of these people, was moving too fast with insufficient consideration of risk. It was full speed ahead on the development of this stuff. As details came out, it became apparent that there was, you know, it was a more complicated story. There was just some kind of interpersonal conflict that was maybe correlated with and not unrelated to the other dynamic, the kind of philosophical dynamic. But it was a more complicated story. And I'm now people did say, well, people who are casting it as this in this kind of binary way were saying, well, a couple of the board members were at places or had been at places that got money from Open Philanthropy, which is a big EA philanthropy, I guess, and so on. I'm wondering how you reacted to that story and whether you think the kind of perception of it is off.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was astonished and taken aback, more or less, as everyone was. It wasn't something that I was expecting to happen at all. I think, yeah, you've tried to piece together what was actually motivating the board and what went down. It's interesting that, yeah, it has been quite strongly associated with effective altruism in some ways. I think I understand why that's the case, because, you know, so one of the board members who supported removing Sam had worked at Open Philanthropy, which is certainly influenced by EA ideas. And I think another was on the board of Effective Ventures. I don't know how large the influence was on her versus her influence on effective altruism. But either way, yeah, there certainly were some connections. I think it makes more sense to think, well, wouldn't this have been influenced by concerns about AI safety, which of course extend far beyond just people involved with effective altruism. Tons of people are worried about that now all over the world for all kinds of different reasons. And that was, I mean, very natural to assume that that was the explanation. It's kind of what I would have guessed as well if I had to guess on the day. But as I think you've pointed out on the show before, they all kind of deny that it was anything to do with AI safety directly, that they had any disagreements about what OpenAI was doing. It wasn't as if the board wanted them to not release a product or not pursue some research angle or whatever. I think my best guess is that that is narrowly true, that there was no disagreement about, you know, should they be training GPT-5 or should they be investigating QStar or whatever it was. But the board, as they said roughly, they no longer believed that Sam Altman was the person with the right temperament to be doing this incredibly important, maybe historical work, that they'd found him a bit shifty or unreliable. They didn't like some of the side deals that he was doing. They just thought he seemed a bit reckless, maybe, that he didn't have the seriousness, perhaps, that they wanted to see in the CEO of OpenAI. And so seeing some of those warning signs, they said, well, if Sam Altman's not the person, then we need to get rid of him and replace him with someone else. And that's kind of, in their mind, I think, was what they viewed as being their job as the board of this nonprofit that controlled OpenAI. They were kind of put there to focus on safety and reliability and the interests of society as a whole over and above OpenAI's interests as a business that might want to make money.
Yeah.
So I would guess that that was in their minds. It doesn't seem like it worked out very well.
I don't think anybody has said to the board, well played, in the wake of it. No.
I mean, it might have been that they had a very poor set of cards to play, because maybe Microsoft was just so influential to, because they were providing so much of the money. They had the team that could influence the media much more than the board had, perhaps. But yes, it doesn't seem like things have worked out poorly, I would say, from their point of view. But yeah, I mean, well, I don't have any particular insight into what they did. So to some extent, we might just have to wait and hope that eventually the story comes out in more detail.
Yeah, there was reporting that one of the board members, is it Helen Toner? Is that her name?
Yeah.
She had, I mean, first of all, it's a fact that she had co-authored a paper that did that raised questions about whether OpenAI was being as careful as, say, Anthropic, which was founded by people who left OpenAI because they were concerned OpenAI wasn't concerned enough about risk, and which, by the way, got some enough money from SBF that some people are saying ultimately SBF may be able, that all of the people who lost money in that may actually ultimately get the money back, because some of it was invested in Anthropic, which has been doing well. But that aside, the reporting was that Altman had not only confronted her about that, but tried to get her kicked off the board, and in the course of doing that, had misled other board members about the position of other board members on whether to kick her off. In other words, in this scenario, he would go to somebody and say, well, you know, so-and-so on the board is ready to get rid of her, and when that wasn't quite true. This is just allegations reported. I have no idea if it's true, but that's the kind of backstory you heard.
Yeah, you can see how that would rub people the wrong way and might give them real question marks if they think, well, the CEO of OpenAI could end up being one of the most important you know, influences of the next decade, then maybe we want someone who we have greater confidence in than that. I mean, maybe the thing I'm very interested to hear more about that I haven't seen covered, maybe that's my fault for not looking in the right places, but so Ilya Sutskever was also on the board. I think he'd worked with Sam Altman for a very long time. He was a technical researcher, like one of the gurus on the ML research side, and also one of the leaders of the research into how do you make AI do what we don't we want? How do we align it? And it seemed like he changed from supporting Sam Altman as CEO to thinking that they needed to remove Sam Altman as CEO. At some point, he changed his mind. I wonder why. And then it seems like he changed it back. I think he was the swing vote, perhaps.
I think so.
And it would be very fascinating to know what was going on in his head. But as far as I know, he hasn't said.
And there was conjecture again about personal drama there or professional drama there, where was he, you know, did he, was Altman treating him as well in the company as he'd like? Had he recently gotten an implicit demotion or was there a hiring that he found threatening, or was he not getting enough resources? All conjectural. Wouldn't shock me given my view of human psychology if some of this was indeed in play, but I think there were real philosophical stakes as well. Listen, I mentioned the fact that the Non-Zero Foundation is now largely crowdfunded. And one implication of that is that generally with these podcasts, we do, you know, have quite a long conversation for the public, but then at some point go into overtime, and that is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. And we are very close to that point. And if you want to become a paid subscriber, you can Google Non-Zero on Substack or just click the link in your show notes. And after that, you know, you can set up a podcast feed where you'll always have access to the overtime segment. So if you want to listen to the rest of this, or you just think we're doing good work and you want to support it, I encourage that. Now, before we do that, I want to do two things, Rob, before we bring down the paywall. One is to give you a chance to say anything you would like to say by addition or qualification to make sure that the public audience hears it. The other is to note something that that we agreed I would note. You had said that on your podcast, you always give people the right to review the transcript. And if there's something, some little thing they wish they had said otherwise or something, and they really think it's important, they can have it edited out. And they almost never do. You ask if you could have that privilege. I said, sure, so long as we inform people that those were the circumstances under which it was recorded, A, and B, so long as if you're asking for things I consider egregious, I can just say, well, I'll just not run the podcast, which of course is a power all podcast operators have anyway, I guess. But
yeah.
So anyway, this is that full disclosure I mentioned. I kind of doubt we've said anything so far that you'll find would be career ruining. But who knows? It's a nasty world out there. You never know.
That's true. Yeah.
Is there anything you would like to add to what we've said already?
Yeah. So, well, I suppose if you enjoyed this, then maybe go subscribe to the 80,000 Hours podcast. Mm-hmm. As I said in the intro, it's a show about the world's most pressing problems and what you can potentially do to contribute to solving them. We do allow guests to review the transcript afterwards, and we put quite a bit of polish into the interviews. And I think it's a good strategy because it allows people to be extremely candid during the interview. And then almost always after the fact, they decide that they want to keep the things in. But it means that they don't have to be constantly thinking about whether they're willing to have what they're saying go out as they're actually trying to form the words.
Right.
So I think you actually get more candidness by allowing people to edit the interview afterwards. I guess in terms of other stuff, well, so effective altruism has been in the news a bunch, and a lot of people have only just learned about it now. And I guess that they've learned about it through things that are either very seriously bad or at least kind of scandalous and interesting. But there's also just a lot of stuff that's been going on for a long time that I think people would generally regard as very good, even if they're somewhat less interesting and less likely to hit the headlines. You know, people and organizations involved with effective altruism have been involved in funding phase 3 trials for a new malaria vaccine and getting it approved by the WHO faster than it otherwise would have. They've been involved in getting up Proposition 12, this California ballot initiative to improve the treatment of farm animals so they're not confined in tiny cages. And then also defending that in front of the Supreme Courts in the US so that it's upheld. Hundreds, thousands of people take a pledge to give 10% of their income to the most effective charities that they can find to make the future better and to make the present better. Less likely to hit the front page of the New York Times, but I think admirable work. I really like a lot of the people who are involved in all of those projects and who are doing their best to try to make the world a better place. So I don't know. I'll just say respect to those people, and I think we shouldn't neglect what they're doing.
Yeah, and I do again encourage people to listen to your podcast. You have a variety of great guests. I have. I think more than once I've been inspired to approach somebody about being on my podcast based on having heard them on yours.
Oh,
even
that's wonderful.
Even in the case of the Ukraine war, Sam, what's his last name? It ran.
Sheriff.
Is it? We're both.
Yeah, it's almost that. Yeah.
Probably within acceptable mispronunciation range if we look at how it's act, but we may have it slightly off. But anyway, he was a great guest. I had him on my podcast. That was great. So thank you for that. You've had a lot of good stuff on AI, which I think is
You should get Nathan LeBenz on your show. I spoke to him a great length about OpenAI and other AI related topics last month. And I think you enjoyed that interview, which came out just before Christmas.
And I listened to his podcast, Cognitive Revolution. He's a very smart guy and seems very sensible. I will try to do that. So anyway, thanks everybody who's listened up to this point. Again, I encourage you to stay with us, but whether or not you do, thank you. And with that, we will go into overtime.